and alcohol. And it really was when I went to work in the first winery where I had the opportunity to start to learn about wine that I became completely intrigued. Mm-hmm. Right? And the fact that this all starts with a plant, right? So in this day and age, the opportunity to actually make something that is seasonal and that is actually based on a growing entity on a plant, I think is really, I mean, we talk about high tech these days and we forget about the fact that our life is really all about the sun coming up and the plants that we grow and the plants that we eat. And the seasonality of that. Mm-hmm. And wine reflects all that. And there is a culture with wine and food that is, I think, a fantastic expression of the human experience. So having an opportunity, and this, as I've got further and further into wine, I would have more and more of these opportunities to spend time with people like yourself who have got interesting backgrounds but have been attracted to wine and food. And you suddenly find yourself having these really fascinating conversations. And wine is sort of a catalyst for that. Mm-hmm. And I totally love that. Plus, I'm this incredible, as you've discovered in our conversation, an incredible science geek when it comes to wine. And I'm very intrigued by that. And that then led me to doing a degree at the University of California, Davis in Enology and Bit. I'm very happy I did. One of the big criticisms you hear about Davis is they don't teach you how to be a winemaker, and that's correct. They don't. Winemaking is a craft. You can only learn it by doing it, but by having a science background, it helps you make good decisions. Mm-hmm. And since you only get your raw product once a year, you only get one chance every year to make that decision. Yeah. So I see it as a tool. The science is a tool to help me make better decisions. Gil Nickel had just bought the Farniente property in 1980. He was 79, 80, and I was just graduating from Davis. He found out about me. We had a conversation, and he hired me to be his first full-time winemaker. Gil had started the Farniente brand, making Chardonnay with a consultant, and I was the first person that went to work for him full-time. The wines were actually being made in a little warehouse in Sausalito. And while we restored the 100-year-old building that is Farniente today.
Yes.
I helped with that whole project and moved the winery. And at that point, we were only making Chardonnay. And I think it's that experience that really drove my continuing love of Chardonnay. I mean, I just, Chardonnays are really important to me.
But he was also making, you were making it more in the French style.
That was the goal. For me, it was an incredibly great experience because I discovered that it's possible for Gil to have his own opinion about how that works and what that means and me to have my opinion, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's, we oftentimes don't realize how important the owner is when we're talking about terroir. I think here in the States, we have an incredibly simplistic view of terroir. We think of it's, oh, it's just the soils and the climate. And it's way more than that. And the person who owns the vineyard, who controls the brand, and whose vision, you know, we tries to wrap this all up, has a huge impact on the way the wines come out. And so...
But he does, mm-hmm. But what is... Mm-hmm. When someone says that, I guess the French says terroir gives the wine a sense of place.
Correct.
So you're saying that someone else can affect the sense of place by doing the winemaking process. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. To me, the ultimate challenge in winemaking, the reason why I have Britain Vineyards today, it's an estate project. I grow my own grapes. I have my own winery. I make my own wines. And it's all about what that piece of ground tastes like in this given vintage. And that to me is the most challenging kind of winemaking, because here you're trying to limit the winemaking artifact. You're trying to keep the hand of the winemaker not visible, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's possible. It's possible for an owner or a winemaker to manipulate grapes in a way to get a certain end result, which may obscure mm-hmm. where the grapes come from. And if you think of a lot of the large brand blended wines mm-hmm. where they're consistently giving you the same wine year after year after year, that's a desirable thing.
Yes.
But when you're talking about, as you mentioned, Burgundy mm-hmm. and high-end product, you know, high-end wineries like Britain, where the idea is to actually showcase the site, the soil, the climate. That's a different type of winemaking.
Let's move on just a little bit. Stagsley, and then mm-hmm. you also spoke of doing some work at Aubryon.
No, I didn't work there. I just had an opportunity to spend some time hanging out there.
That's a beautiful property, Aubryon.
It's a staggeringly beautiful property.
I'm going
right.
back there for our premiere coming up in the third week of April for the Bordeaux premiere. There.
Right. Good for you. Lucky
so,
you.
So what about Stagsley? What did you get out of that experience?
Okay, so... I was the general manager and winemaker at Stagsley Winery from 1988 through 2005. So it's my longest, before starting my own brand, it was the longest single place that I stayed as a winemaker. And that's, we're talking about Stagsley Winery, so that's the original Stagsley property, not Wine Cellars, the more famous of the two, right?
So I've had both of my podcasts.
Have you? Good.
They attempted to explain it to me, but I'm like, you guys got the same damn name, right?
Right.
Yeah, but almost. Everything separates right. with the
apostrophe,
right?
Yeah. 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 It was, in fact, it was my marketing salesman guy at the time.
Did you come up with that?
Who came up with, no, my marketing guy came up with that. He said, he called it the apostrophe wars.
Yeah. But both make really good wines.
They're incredibly good wines. The original Stagsley property was the original property where the name came from. So the Meisner family, who you maybe have heard this name mm-hmm. here in Boca Raton and here in South Florida, same family, started Stagsley in the 1880s, 1890s, the winery was built and called Stagsley. That property was at that time owned by a guy by the name of Carl Domini, who hired me in 88 to start making the wines. And I eventually ended up replanting majority of the vineyards and rebuilt the winery and the gorgeous, this beautiful stone manor house there and those things. I lived on the property for a long time. I just felt like it was mine. In fact, I had a small ownership at one point. And then that was all sold and it became part of a much larger corporate group, which is today known as Treasury Wine Estates.
They bought up a lot of things lately. I think they bought BV lately.
Did they pick up BV recently? I haven't been paying attention.
BV. They mm-hmm. picked up quite a few. Okay, so let's go forward. At mm-hmm. some point, you felt like you wanted to go out on your own.
Correct.
For your reasons, you picked Oregon, right?
That's correct. So I had become intrigued by Pinot Noir.
Okay, we're going to continue the conversation with Robert Britton from Britton Vineyards. He's talking about his journey to Oregon. Go ahead. Thank you.
So I had become intrigued with Pinot Noir because I'm just one of these people who needs to know. I had started making Pinot Noir under my own little label in Napa because it didn't make any sense at Stag's Leap. After we had become part of the corporate behemoth, they came to me and said, "Hey, Robert, you can't have your own label." I discontinued that, but I continued to be interested and started looking for ground on the Sonoma coast to grow Pinot Noir and start my own label. And so about 99, 2000, I had started to date the woman, Ellen Hunt at that time, who was running Les Rudd's property, Rudd Estates in Oakville.
Oh, yeah.
And great estate. Yeah. And I was running, actually she was running Rudd. We had met many, many years before when we were both married to other people and discovered us both separated. And she became an important part of my life. And she said, "Robert, why aren't you spending more time looking in Oregon?"
Oh, okay.
And I said, "Well, because I've done some consulting up there, and I just the world of wine in Oregon is moving, but just knowing how long it takes, that I'm not sure there's really that going to be that many people making those kinds of great wines that quickly." And but she said, "I think Oregon. I'd rather live in Oregon." And I said, "Well, I'll add it to the list."
Okay.
You know, so we started looking at, I started looking property up that way and very quickly and started tasting a lot more wines, paying a lot more attention. And so it very soon became very apparent to me that Oregon was the choice.
Mm-hmm.
And we eventually zeroed in on 3 or 4 different properties that I thought could satisfy me in my quest for wine for the rest of my life. And I was really compelled to make a unique version of Pinot Noir, wine that is not like everybody else's standard vision
everybody
of Pinot Noir. As in terms of the general.
Okay.
So like, if you were to ask somebody about what does an Oregon Pinot Noir taste like,
yes,
or what does a Sonoma Pinot Noir mm-hmm. taste like, what's really compelling to me about Burgundy is because of the 300 years or that they've been making wines, they've sorted out like this area produces wines that are like this, and they don't taste like this next village over here, right? And they don't, because not just the winemaking, but because of the site, right? And so I was trying to find something. I also am really intrigued by ageable wines, right? So I was looking for a site that had more complex flavor profile and more intense phenolic extraction.
Okay, so what's your top three things that makes a wine to have the ability to age? What's the three components, probably?
Acid and pH. I mean, they're tied together, right?
But so pH is an expression.
Acid high, pH low.
Low.
That's correct. Phenolic extract.
Okay. Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the intent to make an age-worthy wine, which has to drive your winemaking.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you have to make decisions about your grape growing process and your winemaking process. And that usually means things like lower crop yields in the vineyard.
Mm-hmm.
It means minimal handling in
which
the cellar.
Which some people are not willing to do to reduce the yield means they lose a month.
And that's... truthfully... I lose money every year.
Yeah, you're
right?
Probably losing
right?
money.
I know, but
you're happy.
I am very happy. That's exactly. That's what drives.
Yeah.
Passion is what drives the
exactly.
world, my friend, as you know, or you wouldn't be doing what you do.
Oh, 100%.
Right?
Okay. Right. That was interesting. Okay.
This is why I consult.
Yeah. Let's talk about the consulting.
Uh-huh.
You're like consulting. You're becoming like... you know, who's the guy?
No, I am not.
You're not like any other hired hands.
Well, there are other hired guns out there,
like
but let's talk about it.
Paul Hobbs,
yeah.
I'm a big fan of Paul Hobbs.
Yeah.
And Michelle Roland is probably the ultimate hired.
Right.
Guy, yeah.
Right.
But
right.
No, you do this. You're hired gun because are you're consulting or you're making the wine?
Both.
And talk about the couple people
So for example, but let me put this in perspective,
okay,
because what's important for me is I only work with people that own their own vineyards.
That's
hugely important. I only work with estate projects,
mm-hmm,
right? And I only work with people who have their own vision
mm-hmm.
of their wine, because I don't make wines for points. I don't make wines for...
You're not trying to get 100-pointer?
I am not.
Yeah.
And it's really important to me that you understand that.
I just interviewed Russell Babbins, and that's really important to him.
There you go.
There you go.
So these are the
but
kinds
anyway,
of...
Okay,
yeah.
But different vision.
So, but I want them to have their own vision, because as I said earlier, I think one of the key components to defining terroir for a given site is the vision of the owner, right? And so if you make a decision, so for example, I make the wines and help drive the winemaking process for the Winderly program in Oregon. Bill and Donna, who own the winery, they have a very strong vision of what they want those wines to be. It is a biodynamic property. We make the wines under the biodynamic sensibility. That's very important to them. And that shapes the wines, and their vision shapes the wine. And my job as a consultant is to make the very best wines from their vineyard in their vision. And that's challenging and a hell of a lot of fun. It's as opposed to simply saying, here's my recipe, we'll make your wine according to my recipe.
So that must keep you very busy, because you're consulting or making wine at what, like 4 or 5 different places?
No, I actually only make wine at one place, my own winery.
Yeah.
But I bring my clients' grapes into that facility.
Oh, into your facility.
That's correct. So my staff.
That makes it a little bit easier to deal with.
Well, exactly. It makes it a hell of a lot, especially with the intensity and the attention that I put into winemaking. I have a 3-person staff who are amazing winemakers on their own part that support me in that facility.
So Britain Vineyard, right, must be a boutique?
Yes, very much.
And how much do you make?
We make 2,500 cases a year, that's all. Okay. And 100% out of the estate fruit. We don't buy fruit.
And how are you selling these? Are you doing it through a club? Are you doing a retail?
We're a little different in that sense. For being that small, we have a high proportion of our wines are actually sold outside the state of Oregon. Most wineries that size are 100% direct in the state.
So why are you like that?
Because I believe, and Ellen believes, that these wines are intended for high-end dining, for people who get fine wine and fine food. And so when we first launched the brand, our first vintage was 2006. We had a small group of small boutique distributors who had highly motivated, generally it's one or two sales staff in any given market who are motivated to sell wines to the most intriguing chefs and sommeliers. And that's where we want our wines. And so that's why we made that a decision. So as you know, that means that the wines, we get a much smaller amount of wine paid to us, because we are basically someone else's selling the wine directly to the consumer. But it's the way to get our wines into the consumer, for example, here in Miami.
Yes.
Right.
Do you have a wine club?
We do.
Okay, you do. Okay. And if someone wanted to get on your wine club, join your wine club, which I would recommend, because, well, just to probably get the Syrah that we haven't tasted today, right, Robbie? And then the Chardonnay is
You're going to kick me on that, right?
You'll send me a bottle or something one day, and I'll do a review on it. But the Chardonnay is simply amazing. Let's talk about the wines a little bit.
Okay.
Chardonnay.
Yeah.
And this was the
2022 Chardonnay, just released.
Just released. Anything, I mean, in the winemaking process, anything notable that we should know about?
So you know, it's interesting about my winemaking is, after all the science and all the years of learning, my winemaking has actually become simpler and simpler, more simple, perhaps. So I would say this Chardonnay is made in a very classic, I hate to keep referring to Burgundy because this is not Burgundy, but made in what I consider to be a very classic Burgundian tradition, in that the grapes are, of course, handpicked whole cluster into the press. They are pressed, the juice is allowed to settle overnight, and then it goes into French oak barrels. It's 100% barrel fermented, 100% through malolactic.
What does that mean?
So,
in layman terms.
Yeah. So.
Well, I know, but these people listening might not know.
Right. I got. Yeah. So what that really means is that we transfer the juice from the grape directly into a barrel. We fill it up about a little more than 3/4 full, and then either wait for the juice to start fermenting on its own or inoculate with yeast. And the fermentation of the sugars is complete, at which point the barrel, sometimes before the sugar is complete, but generally after, the wine will start to undergo malolactic fermentation. So that's the secondary fermentation almost all wines go through. And the second most prevalent acid in wines is the malic acid. We have tartaric acid and malic acid. The malic acid is what you taste in the back of your palate, whereas the tartaric you taste in the front of your palate. The malic generally has a sourness to it. These bacteria ferment, meaning they use the malic acid as an energy source, and they convert it to lactic acid, which is the principal acid in milk. Yeah, and your palate receives that as a much softer, less bitter acid, so you don't notice it much. It also adds some complexity to the wine in terms of flavor, as well as changing the mouthfeel. It is a traditional thing that happens with almost all red wines, and with some whites to some degree. Just as a little aside, because you know me, I like to go down these rabbit holes. Just let me talk a little bit about some today, because of climate change and the lack of acidity, because we respire acid with warmer temperatures. Literally, acid comes out of the berries with warmer temperatures before we pick them. And so more and more winemakers are using malic acid as a way to increase the acidity of their Chardonnays. And you'll get that, you'll find a different mouthfeel in the wines because of that.
I was under the understanding that a lot of times the higher acid comes when you pick the grapes that's not as ripe as others.
That's correct. So the acid is there to deter the bird from eating the grape before the seed is mature.
I never thought of that one. Okay.
So when you're trying to make that decision on when to pick, which is the most critical decision, right? What you're really looking for is that point at which the acid starts to decline and the ripeness of the fruit is increasing. And there's a point there where you make that picking decision. And more, as our picking temperatures warm up, we are finding ourselves making those decisions on the basis of acid rather than on sugar. Because we actually want lower sugars. We want less alcohol potential. We're trying to get alcohols down lower, and for most winemakers these days, we've kind of...
Well, I don't think in Napa Valley they're looking for lower sugars.
I think they are. You know what I mean? So you know what's interesting? having made wine in Napa for a long time, you know, the wines that I enjoy out of my cellar that are 25, 30 years old, that I made in Napa.
I might have to check that out.
You should come visit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
I'm going to be in Oregon this summer.
Good.
I might have to stop by. But
Those wines were picked with alcohol potentials of 13%, 12.5%, right? And they've held up beautifully well. And in fact, they've held up, I would argue, better than some of these wines that are picked at 14, 15, 16% alcohol.
Okay, let me ask you another question. Is there deception in what they say is the amount of alcohol on the label?
Yes. So you are allowed legally, according to the TTB, you are allowed a percent and a half swing.
1% and a half?
A swing on your label.
So if someone puts out that this is 15, it could actually be 16.5?
That's correct.
What the hell? Really? Okay. All right, we'll move on from this. But that means that, yours 12.8.
That's on the Pinots that you're looking at right now. They are 12. I try to be as honest on the label as possible. But again, we have to print the labels long before bottling, right?
Exactly.
So by the time we get the final tweaks in the blend, it might be 12.5 instead of 12.8. So there's some latitude there. But the 1.5 swing really is to help the larger wineries who do multiple bottlings.
Exactly.
So I don't have to replant the label every time.
Yeah, like my guy JCB. I mean, him and his wife Gala, as much wine as they make, you know.
Correct.
Exactly. So we're gonna move on. Chardonnay's outstanding.
Right.
I recommend
Thank
it.
You.
It looks like Robbie, is the $38 is that retail on the Chardonnay, or that's what's the 30? The 38 is that retail or? Wholesale. Everything's wholesale on it. So you can probably, double it. It's going to be about $60, $65, I'd say. It's outstanding.
No, 50. It's going to be about $50.
About $50. Mm-hmm. It's outstanding, right. And I think it's well worth it. It's been a while, bro. I tell you that. Let's move on to the state Pinot Noir that I mm-hmm. thought was really elegant. I mean, I thought it was easy to drink, and it was. Let me ask you this: are you trying to get your wines as close as possible to being not organic, not natural, but your wines are very clean and pure, and they have great flavors to it? Do you have?
Thank you.
Do you have a? What's your objective?
So my objective is to make the wine as environmentally sound as I can. So stewardship of the property is first and foremost. I use minimal amounts of everything we spray on the grapes is called a pesticide, but my vineyard is actually organic. I don't certify organic. Because I'm not one of these joiners, and because I am organic, my carbon footprint is actually larger than if I wasn't. So it's like, which at this point, staring with climate change staring at me, is it more important that I have a lower carbon print, or is it more important that the chemistry that I use in the vineyard? That's not really an argument, because I'm not going to put anything on the grapes. I live at the vineyard. I drink my own wines. My kids are there. There's nothing that I'm going to put on the grapes, right? That is going to mess with anything. But it's one of these things you have to think about when you go like, oh, I'm going to be organic. Well, it means that you're going to run that tractor, that diesel tractor through your vineyard. You're going to compact the soils more. You have to think about those things. And for me, that's I'm a very thoughtful steward of that land. And so my wines, minimal handling. We basically don't add anything to the wine other than we do use sulfur dioxide at a very specific point in the winemaking process.
You gotta use it. Do you have cover crops in between?
I do.
You do?
Totally. And the cover crops, you and I could spend an hour talking about cover crops. I like to do that, because it's one of the biggest mistakes I ever made. Was by taking the cover crop that I developed in Napa and taking it to Oregon. It totally didn't work. It almost killed my vineyard. And again, this is one of those things where you think you know more than Mother Nature, and you think you can make, by trying to make a more perfect soil, you know, through the complexity of permanent cover crop, you actually end up causing the vine damage. Almost killed the vineyard. So you
they can get very aggressive.
That's exactly correct. And outcompete the vine for water.
Oh, wow. Okay. You don't want that. Okay. All right, let's move on. So that's the estate Pinot Noir.
Correct. Oh, no, we actually hadn't didn't talk about the estate Pinot. We talked about the Chard. Let me just mention that. So my intent with this vineyard was, I bought a piece of property because of the geology and the aspects, I thought I could make different expressions of Pinot Noir because of the site. Not winemaking, which I have done. And in the process of doing that, I became aware that the vineyard itself is unique. And I wanted to represent that with a wine that was an overview of the site. Plus, as the vines matured, there was one block that I became aware that didn't really fit into the basalt block that makes the basalt wine. And so I took it out and used it as the basis for the estate wine, which then also gets blended wines from the other blocks. So it is made from all of the blocks in the vineyard. So if you can imagine, this hillside that has a concave bowl in it, in the middle of that hillside, we have these uplifted ancient marine basalts that are 30, 50 million years old that have been pushed up to the surface. They decomposed. They're very high in minerals because these rocks were formed under the ocean. Mm-hmm. So they're full of calcium and sodium and potassium and magnesium. They've decomposed into soil. And in that part of the vineyard, that's where the roots are. And that makes the basalt block. The Cygnus block, which will be the first wine that you and I are going to talk about here, that's a separate little hill. The vineyard drops off to the east, so it's all about the morning sun, whereas the basalt is north-south. It gets the whole, including the afternoon sun, so morning sun versus afternoon sun, very important.
Is one more important than the other?
Is one more important than the other?
Most people plant vineyards southwest, no?
Yeah, they do. They found them. Yeah, and my vineyard is exactly north south because at this point, when that vineyard was planted, the original planters of that vineyard, and myself too for that matter, really thought that we were really going to struggle to get ripeness in that vineyard. Mm-hmm. And so it was really taking a big chance when I decided to put the Cygnus block in with east-west rows on an east slope.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So it changes the flavor profile and the texture of the wine.
I'm sure.
Right? Yes.
I'm sure.
And then the third wine, just to set the geology right, the third wine that we have, which is the Heritage.
Right?
You have the estate, we have the basalt.
The Cygnus basalt.
Basalt.
But you didn't talk about. Tell me a little bit about the basalt.
Okay.
So, what did the name come from?
From those ancient marine basalts.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
The basalts are actually what we are lava flows, right?
Yes, okay.
Right? And those ancient lava flows that were then uplifted because of plate tectonics is what really drives the basalt series, whereas the Cygnus series, which have those ancient basalts underneath it, but there's soil that is the result of later volcanic activity where basalt lava flows were actually laid down on top of the ancient basalts and then decomposed. The Cygnus is made up of those series of soil. So and the wines are very different because of the geology, the soils, and the aspect.
Okay.
And then in the area where I grow the Heritage, that has a small amount of ancient marine sedimentary soils, which are the material that fell out of the ocean and became ocean bottom and then was scraped up and uplifted. So that changes. So in Oregon, you start looking at those major soil differences amongst the AVAs, and it's what makes some of the Oregon Pinot Noirs, defines the Oregon Pinot Noirs. And I kind of have the whole mix on my property.
Yeah, but it's very different than California Pinot Noirs. I mean, I think that I can easily detect the difference between the two.
Very much.
Yes. Very much so. At times I can get them a little confused with Burgundy. Not Burgundy at the highest level, but maybe in the village level and the Pinot Cruz in a sense. But in closing, and we're gonna just go back to this because I think it's a good topic. Okay, tell me about the Syrah, man. I mean, even though you decided to make Syrah. I think you told a little story while we're at lunch.
Right.
Because.
Right. Well, I had an opportunity to drink some Cornas with a small producer, and it was completely unexpected. And I think those kinds of wine experiences may be the most compelling. And I think we all have those kinds of stories to tell where we just unexpectedly find ourselves drinking a wine that just kind of messes with us, right? It either blows your mind completely because you understand wine, or it just totally like, I don't get this, right? And that was one of those experiences. the proprietor later apologized to me for not pouring an older wine for lunch. This one was only 15, it was a Syrah, was only 15 years old. It was a Fornos. And it made me start to think about Syrah the way I think about, well, at that time was thinking about where I plant Cabernet, where I plant Cab Franc, that kind of thing. But later on, it became like, I actually think Syrah is more similar to Pinot in that it can be very site-specific. And so I have planted Syrah in all of the vineyards that I have developed or owned over the years, trying to understand it. The best expression of Syrah and the most exciting expression of Syrah is the stuff that I've planted in the Willamette Valley on in a very cool, windy site. My vineyard, and it makes a Syrah that does not taste like what you normally think. In this country, we tend to think of Syrahs as being high alcohol, jammy, rich wines. Yes. But if you really taste, you know, the best of Côte Rôti, the best of Cornas, you've got these wines that can be very, very full of lots of depth, very structured wines that are very exciting and age beautifully. My Syrah approaches that type of an expression of that grape.
Have you experienced maybe a little Viognier in there?
That's an interesting question, because actually I do grow a small amount of Viognier.
I love Viognier.
On the property. Do you?
A really, really exciting grape variety. I really do.
It is, but it is so dependent on where it's grown that you don't see very many really great Viognier.
A lot of people tell me that when you put Viognier in the Syrah, you got to be careful of the amount, because Viognier can become a very powerful grape and take over.
Exactly correct. That is exactly correct. Yeah, yep.
Mm-hmm. And moving, and with Gure, close up real quick. Your wife, Ellen, she loves champagne, so you decided to make champagne, right? Good guy.
Well, I can't
Good
make God. I Good can't God. Make champagne because I'm not in champagne.
Well, you make,
but
you
make know, sparkling
you make
wine.
Sparkling, yes.
Yeah, I do. I do.
Is that available in your wine club, the sparkling?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I'm going to have to join your wine club. I'm not in too many wine clubs in this world at all.
Why don't you come visit?
I am going to come visit. I think I'm going to be out there in July of this year. Yeah. Sometime in July, I'll be out in Oregon.
Well, I would love to pour the Syrah and the sparkling
right
for you.
You're in McMinnville area?
We're in, right in downtown McMinnville.
Yeah, I usually stay at this little bed and breakfast that's down there.
Uh-huh.
Also, I like visiting the Carlton Wine.
The studio?
The studio also. Yeah, I like going by there.
I made wine at one point there for a while. My wife GM'd that property for a while.
Oh, really?
So I know the studio really well. A very good friend of mine runs it today that you should get to know. His name's Anthony King.
Well, I would love to get to
Very,
know
him, another transplanted California winemaker.
Okay. Very good. Mm-hmm. Hey, Robert, great conversation. And thank you, Robbie, for inviting me here today, bro. I appreciate it. And I'll get this up in about a week after we filter through it or whatever.
You're gonna
appreciate it. Robert Britton from Britton Vineyards in McMinnville in Oregon. It's not Portland, it's just Oregon.
It's
right?
Willamette Valley.
In the Willamette Valley. Cheers. Thank you for the conversation.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.